Welcome to episode 155 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. Thanks to Jay for his generous Patreon contribution. We have a long interview this week, so let's get right to it. Steve Hinks is the press officer for the UK Association of HPV Vaccine Injured Daughters. It was formed in 2015 to provide support for families with a daughter whose health suffered after this vaccine. The organization connects families, campaigns for greater awareness of the risks, for better medical help for the injured daughters, to protect families from being blamed for the illnesses, and to receive better treatment by doctors. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you.
So tell me how you first became concerned about the side effects of the HPV vaccine.
Well, the first concerns were in May 2011. Our daughter had had a third shot of HPV vaccine at school, and her mum got a call within 2 hours of having the shot to go and collect her from school, unwell.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of symptoms did she have initially?
Feeling unwell, feeling flu-like.
Mm-hmm.
She had terrible headaches, aching joints, feeling tired, fatigue. It was the time of school exams, and she was very much into her education and exams. And
right.
She actually went back to school for a few weeks, but really, really struggled. And then one day she just collapsed and just could not do any more. We took her to the GP, and mm-hmm. the GP thought that she'd either got a brain tumour or I think leukemia was another of the suspicions, and rushed straight to hospital.
And the GP obviously didn't say anything about vaccines or anything else like that?
No.
Okay, and so at the hospital, what did they find there?
Well, they did all the tests. They did an MRI scan, couldn't find anything. They suspected it was chronic fatigue, chronic fatigue syndrome, and they just said you need to push yourself. They went on to say, it's all in your head, there's nothing wrong with you.
Really?
My daughter was sleeping 23 hours a day at the time, couldn't wake her up.
I don't know if she was a teenager, I mean, I know teenagers can be pretty obstreperous, and I can see a teenager sleeping 23 hours a day, one day, just to make a point.
No,
but to think that this would go on, I mean, that's absurd, really.
In September 2011, September the 16th, she went into a three-month coma-like sleep. She was never really fully conscious at any of that time. We used to get her semi-conscious for two or three times a day to spoon-feed her liquidized food.
Wow. I'm sorry. That's pretty rough. And have things improved at all, or are things
they have.
The same?
We've had a really tough time with the NHS here in the UK. They completely, totally, utterly deny any problems with the vaccine. They say the vaccine is safe and effective.
Mm-hmm.
And they accuse girls and their families of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. They send in the psychiatrist, and they blame you. They investigate you and make allegations.
Who's inventing it? You and your wife are inventing this, or your daughter?
Well, they investigated our family.
Right, everybody.
On two occasions. And when I eventually obtained the minutes of the meetings that had taken place, when they decided that we went at fault, I found 170 inaccuracies, gross inaccuracies, and blatant lies, all by NHS health professionals.
All in order to preserve their pre-existing assumption that the vaccine is safe. So if anything is found, we have to explain our way out of this. We cannot accept that this was a case of a vaccine adverse reaction.
That's correct, yes.
And I mean, in some cases, people have had an adverse reaction that some people have thought was related to a vaccine days or weeks after the vaccine. But in this case, your daughter's symptoms started almost immediately.
Almost immediately. And in fact, Lucy had been quite healthy in recent years. And when we looked back through the medical records, she'd actually been to see the GP twice, once with a sore shoulder, joints in her shoulder, and once with flu-like symptoms after the first and second dose. But we hadn't recognized those as being possible adverse reactions.
Right.
It was at the time the first and second dose were given in October and November, so towards the end of the school term. Long school term, lots of homework, weather not great, so we thought she was just tired and fatigued and aching with flu-like symptoms because of the time of year.
And she'll be better after the Christmas holidays.
Yeah. And things did improve until the third dose, and that reaction was immediate.
What were your thoughts about vaccines prior to your daughter having these incredible symptoms following the third HPV dose?
Well, I was very supportive of vaccination, but in actual fact, our daughter had had a serious adverse reaction to the MMR vaccine when she was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
With the MMR vaccine, it was the triple vaccine.
Right.
It hadn't been introduced very long at that time.
Right.
And there were concerns with it raised that appeared to be unfounded.
Mm-hmm.
We suspected that Lucy had got German measles at the time of vaccination, but the
which
GP
is
said,
called rubella, right?
Yeah, but the GP said, no, it's fine, we'll carry on with the vaccination. Immediately, she, for the following 7 to 10 days, she had a full dose of measles.
After being vaccinated?
Yeah, that wasn't too concerning, because as a child, I had measles.
Right, and the explanation for that was probably it was either a coincidence or something?
Possibly. But about a further 10 days after that, she came out in a red rash that wouldn't go away with the glass rolled over it, straight to the GP, rushed straight into hospital, into an isolation ward with suspect meningitis. We had antibiotics, blood taken, very, very difficult to get bloods out, in an isolation ward for 2 days,
right.
And then it was clear. Fright over. But in the meantime, a gland in her throat came off like a lump the size of a golf ball, and it persisted, and it persisted for 9 months. My wife used to be previously the secretary to the ENT surgeon at the hospital.
EMT being?
Ear, nose, and throat surgeon.
Oh, ear, nose, and throat, okay.
And she was concerned that she'd come across cases of small children having cancer. In their neck or throat, so he asked her to do a biopsy.
Right.
He said he would prefer to remove it, and it wouldn't leave the scar would be unnoticeable underneath the chin line.
Right.
It was just a simple 20-minute procedure.
Right.
It lasted 2 hours, and there's another lump underneath as well, but they were benign, which was good news. Our daughter hadn't been able to talk until that point very well.
Right.
But as soon as she had the operation, she could talk almost perfectly immediately.
Okay.
So when we got the consent form for the HPV vaccine, we decided not to to consent. We didn't think it was worth the risk.
So you already had some, like you had seen these experiences earlier as possibly related to the MMR.
Almost. We definitely thought it was related to the MMR. Our daughter didn't have the second vaccine, but our younger daughter did have the vaccine and was okay.
Right.
So she would have it maybe 2 years later, and she didn't have an adverse reaction.
Right.
But when it came to the eldest daughter to have the HPV vaccine, we didn't consent. But the school nurse approached Mum, my wife, and told her that it was nothing like the MMR vaccine, and we were denying our daughter a life-saving opportunity.
And we'll get into whether it really is a life-saving opportunity in a bit, but
I'm sure.
Continue. Let's not get diverted by that, but okay,
yeah.
So you gave in and gave permission then?
My wife signed the consent form.
Mm-hmm.
But we were given no... I've learnt a little bit about informed consent since then.
Right.
At that time, there was no information about any side effects.
Well,
other than
you sent me one document, and you quoted from a number of health agencies. I didn't know all the acronyms, but I recognized NHS, which is the National Health Service, the UK's public health system, and it said that HPV is, quote, a safe vaccine, and, quote, severe reactions are extremely rare.
Correct.
What's the truth of that? I mean, is NHS lying, or is this actually
Well,
true?
I think the agency, the government agency responsible for safety of drugs is called the MHRA. Medical and Health... I don't recall the exact name of the agency.
But regulatory agency or something?
Regulatory,
yeah.
Agency, of course, of course. And they have regular meetings with the JCVI, which is the government agency for the Joint Committee for Vaccinations and Immunization.
Mm-hmm.
And in the public minutes of one of their meetings, the MHRA gave a report to the JCVI subcommittee, HPV subcommittee, that no serious risks have been identified associated with either HPV vaccine in the UK. They say either because when it was first introduced in 2008, it was Cervarix by made by Glaxo SmithKline, but that was replaced by Gardasil, Merck Gardasil, in 2012. But when a question was raised in Parliament to the government, the same MHRA gave a report, and it reported that there'd been, I think it's 9,000 approximately adverse reactions reported by what here in the UK we call the yellow card scheme. I think it would be similar to the VAERS scheme that's used in the United States. But it also reported that there had been 3,038 serious adverse reports.
Wow.
Now, 3,038 serious adverse reports. And when they publicly stated, no serious risks have been identified.
I think the game that they play is that they will say in these reports that these were adverse reactions found after vaccination, but we cannot tell for sure that in every case the adverse reaction was actually causally associated with the vaccination. And therefore they can say, okay, we don't know that there's a causal association. And then they can report, we have no proven causal associations. Because
that
in every
correct.
Case...
And trying to get anybody to do an epidemiology study is very, very difficult because all of the medical professions stick together and all you ever get from them is safe and effective. But what I did, here in the UK, we have the opportunity to ask public bodies to disclose information under the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
So I write to the MHRA and I ask them for copies of their annual reports of vaccine adverse events. They do an annual report to the JCVI, the Joint Committee for...
Vaccines and Immunity.
Immunization, yeah.
Okay.
And you find out that the number of serious adverse reports for HPV vaccine is considerably more than any other vaccine in the national program.
In many cases,
it's 10 times more serious adverse events with HPV vaccine than all of the other common vaccines in the program.
Right, and the UK, I presume, is like Canada or the United States, where there's quite a long list of vaccines that are intended to be given to every child.
Yes.
So HPV is just a small fraction of the
vaccines. Well, I actually do a chart now, which I do publish on sites. They have about 20 different vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this chart since 2008 up to the data goes back to 2008 because that's when the HPV vaccine was introduced into the UK. And I've been comparing the serious adverse reports reported for each of the vaccines. And for HPV, in the last report of 2016, it was 2,653.
In one year?
No, that's from 2008.
So a cumulative number, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of other vaccines have only got 200, 300, 400, mm-hmm. times 500, 600 as serious adverse events, whereas the HPV has got 2,653. That was up until 2016. The total now, currently, is over 3,000.
And does the British government, do any of these agencies estimate what fraction of adverse reactions are actually reported?
Yes. The MHRA, who manage the yellow card reporting scheme, they acknowledge that only 1 to 2% of adverse events are reported and approximately 10% of serious adverse events are reported.
I guess it makes sense that there'd be a higher percentage of serious adverse reactions. I mean, if you inject somebody and they, you know, have a seizure right there, then you're probably going to connect that, whereas if they go home and have a headache the next day, maybe there's a much smaller chance. But still, 10%
I think many people that have their children vaccinated, it's common occurrence to have a sore arm and a headache or possibly a fever,
right,
for a day or two.
Right.
And I don't think people would actually report those.
I don't think
being
most
adverse
people,
events.
Right. But even 10% of serious adverse reactions is not not a very high percentage. I mean, if the 2,000 or 3,000 serious adverse reactions are really 20,000 or 30,000, I mean, we're talking about a major health catastrophe.
Yes.
Okay, so and what are some of the more, I presume out of the serious adverse reactions, you're seeing certain types of reactions more commonly than others. Like, what are some of the reactions, serious reactions that are relatively commonly reported for HPV?
Serious fatigue, mm-hmm. pain, chronic regional pain syndrome is quite a number of the girls have been reported have chronic regional mm-hmm. pain syndrome, but lots of systemic pain. My daughter had a severe migraine type headache almost constantly for 5 years. Now, when they put in the patient information leaflet that is quite common to have a headache after the vaccination, they don't tell you how severe it is or how long it's going to go on for. But many of the girls have suffered with fatigue, somnolence, excessive sleeping, can't wake up, joint problems,
mm-hmm.
Cracking joints, aching joints, abdominal pains, muscle pains and muscle cramps, peripheral coldness, fingers and toes cold,
mm-hmm.
almost certainly due to lack of blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many. There's an absolute multitude of adverse reactions. In fact, although there have been 9,000 reports to the MHRA, 3,038 of them in serious.
Right.
There have been 22,000 adverse reactions reported in those reports, and that's because...
Multiple
symptoms.
Right.
But headaches, pain, there have been quite a number of girls, a considerable number of girls, that have got symptoms of postural orthotachycardia syndrome, which is little known in the NHSE in the UK. And we found that even though we've recommended to parents that have got, their daughters have got the symptoms, and they go to an hospital, and the hospital have never heard of it. They get on the iPad and Google it.
Right. Can you describe, can you define this symptom?
Postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. It's to do with blood flow, I understand.
Okay.
If a person gets up rapidly, they can faint.
I understand. Okay, so they don't have sufficient blood pressure, basically.
My understanding is that the blood pressure is normal, except for when they stand up.
Oh, okay.
And it must be a slow reaction or whatever, but they also suffer with the peripheral coldness, the fingers and toes that are cold, due to lack of blood flow. So I think it's more to do with blood flow rather than blood pressure.
I think one of the motivations for trying to, you know, not talk about these adverse reactions, even though they're documenting them, is that a lot of people strongly believe that the vaccine's effective. Like, you quoted an Irish government minister saying that 90 people would die of cancer and 300 would get treated for cancer because of lack of take-up of the vaccine. But the Nobel Prize Committee in 2008, when they gave the Nobel Prize to Zurhausen, who was the discoverer of HPV and who initiated the claim that it caused cancer, Nobel Prize Committee themselves said, discoveries whether these vaccines are effective in preventing not only against cervical lesions but also cervical cancer and death must await the collection of epidemiological data during the coming decades. In addition, the duration of the vaccine's protection is unclear. Do they provide lifelong immunity or will booster doses be needed? Since the vaccines aim to protect against the two virus strains that caused 70% of the cervical cancers, will other strains emerge as a major cause of the tumors? I mean, that's about as establishment a claim as you can get, I think.
I understand that there is zero evidence that the vaccine will ever prevent a single case of cancer.
The vaccines
tend to be aimed at reducing cervix at just two different types of HPV strains 16 and 18. Gardasil 4 strains. But there are known to be over 170 different strains of HPV, and there are known that 40 of them are connected to or linked to cancers. But there are scientists that claim that HPV is nothing to do with the cancer.
Right. I mean, there are many women. Is it quite a high percentage of women have one or another of the HPV strains, and they're not all dying of cervical cancer.
Absolutely. My understanding is that HPV tends to disappear on its own accord.
Another issue, yes.
But one of the things that I've studied, here in the UK, we have government statistics on the Office of National Statistics database open to the public.
Right.
And they monitor the number of cases of cervical cancer for different age groups. And because they started with the HPV vaccination in 2008 for 12, 13-year-old girls, and they claim a 90% take-up of the vaccine, it's provided free of charge in schools.
Right.
So they claim 90% coverage, and it started in 2008 with 12, 13-year-old girls.
Almost 10 years ago now, right?
Yep. But they also had a catch-up program for girls up to 18 in schools, free of charge. It was a three-year catch-up program, started in 2008, which was so successful that it was completed within 2 years. Now, the reporting of cervical cancers on the Office of National Statistics, they do it by age group.
Okay.
So up to 20. 20 to 24, 24 to 30, and so on.
So some of those groups have now been pretty well completely vaccinated.
The 20 to 24-year age group by now should be 90% vaccinated. But the cases of cervical cancer in England, where it's a separate database, the number of cases is actually increasing. A relatively small increase, but consistently over recent years. There was a report in Scotland recently, headlines in the newspapers, that health officials have reported a 90% reduction in cervical cancers since the vaccination was introduced.
Okay, well,
that was obviously wrong. What they'd actually announced was a 90% reduction in the HPV strains at 16 and 18 present in the vaccine. But I went to look at the statistical database for the Scottish Government, and I found out that although they'd had the similar introduction of HPV vaccine in 2008 with a catch-up program, the number of girls, young women, in the age group 20 to 24 years of age, it was almost four times more cervical cancers being reported in recent, in the last 3 or 4 years than what it was before the vaccine was introduced.
Well, that's pretty shocking. So let's go through.
What I also found was that the total cases of cervical cancer in Scotland for all age groups, not just the 20 to 24 age group, which should be 90% vaccinated, but all age groups, in the 1990s and the early year 2000s, the rate of cervical cancers was dropping quite rapidly as they increased cervical screening.
Right.
It came down from, in the 1990s, it started off at about 500 cases a year, and progressively, it came down to 300 cases a year. So consistently and progressively, over about 20 years, it came down from 500 cases a year to 300 cases a year at the time when the vaccination was introduced. When the vaccination was introduced, they seem to have taken their eye off cervical cancer screening. And the amount of screening being done in Scotland has reduced.
Right.
Not massively, but it has reduced. And the number of cases of, the overall number of cancers of cancer, cases of cancer in Scotland had increased and is currently running at about 400 cases. So over 20 years it had come down from 500 a year to 300 a year, but in recent years it has not just crept back up again, it's gone up quite significantly.
And you're saying
400 cases a year.
Right.
Now I believe that's because they focused more on vaccination and taken their eye off doing cervical cancer screening.
And you said specifically that this 20 to 24 group seems to have a higher rate, four times higher rate than before.
Correct.
That is pretty shocking. But so their claim basically was that of the strains of HPV that we've vaccinated against, we're finding less of those in the cancers that we're finding. But the number of cancers is going up. They didn't say that part. So
Not necessarily in the cancers, but in the precancerous lesions. The early precancer.
Oh, so there's not even any, because you know one of the concerns was that even if the HPV vaccine could reduce the number of precancerous lesions, the question is, can it reduce the number of precancerous lesions that are going to turn into cancer? Because if it has no impact on those, it's going to have no impact on the cancer rate. And so if you can eliminate some of these precancerous lesions that you know maybe you're eliminating the ones that wouldn't have made any difference. How do you know, as the Nobel Prize Committee said, it's going to take decades before we'll know? And what you're saying is already the numbers are not looking very good.
I am seeing the results of the government-owned statistics databases that those in the age group 20 to 24, there is a progressive significant rise in cases of cervical cancer. And now if we have been told that 90% uptake of the vaccine since 2008, including the catch-up program for girls up to 18, now that should have been completed if it was a three-year catch-up program completed within 2 years. That those girls in 2000 that were 18 in 2010, they should all be now in the 20 to 24 age group or more.
Yes, they should have virtually eliminated cervical cancer in that group. You should see
if it was effective.
Yeah, you should see 10% of the level because 90%.
That is what you would expect.
Yes, and we're not seeing that. No. I mean, it is an interesting case because often, you know, vaccination occurs for diseases while the disease is dropping, and so you know you don't really know if the vaccine helped or not, but the rate drops, and you cannot prove that the drop after a vaccine is started, you can't prove that it isn't related to the vaccine, because that's a good thing. There's less disease, and you vaccinated. But in this case, it seems easier to be able to tell whether the vaccine is working or not.
Well, the thing that I think is absolutely crucial here is that the vaccine manufacturers clearly state on their patient information leaflet that it is necessary to do cervical cancer screening even after vaccination.
Do they claim,
That is absolutely clear.
Right. Do they claim...
But what is happening is that young girls and women are thinking they're protected. The government agencies seem to be focusing more on vaccination than on cervical screening. Maybe budgets are tight, but the vaccine is an expensive vaccine, and they're focusing more on vaccination because they expect it to have the benefits that they've been told to expect.
Right.
And when I studied the cervical cancer rates on the Scottish, I mentioned before, it started off at 500 cases a year and came down to 300 cases a year within about 20 years as the cervical screening was increased. Now, I don't think the cervical screening rates were ever above 80% of the population. But if it was almost a straight line graph over the 20-year period,
mm-hmm.
and by about, if that straight line graph had carried on, there would have been zero cases of cervical cancer in Scotland by about 2019, 2020. And my understanding is, if you could do cervical screening 100% of the population, you could prevent cervical cancer.
It seems to be one of the cases. I've interviewed a man named Peter Gotchi before. I don't know if you've heard about him. I think you should have. He works with the Cochrane Institute in Denmark. He's been critical of a number of things, including the HPV vaccine, and also
I've seen their report to the EMA. Yes, it is extremely critical.
Right, and he's also critical of mammography as well. But one thing he did say, I believe it was him who said it, was that there's a lot of problems with the screening tests, but everybody seems to see the Pap smear screening as a big success, unlike mammography, unlike PSA screening, which have turned out to actually be ineffective and actually just cause more biopsies and more psychological stress and things like that.
My understanding is it is probably quite unpleasant for those that have to go through it.
Right.
But my understanding is it is virtually 100% effective and can prevent all cases of cervical cancer.
Yes, and yet...
And it's still required after vaccination. So the cost to the government is going to increase. The delta is going to be the cost of the vaccination. You still should be doing the cervical cancer screening. Now, as I say, the cervical cancer screening is reduced in Scotland, and the overall all-age group cancers have gone up quite significantly.
I mean, I guess the question is the role of the NHS really to improve the health of the British people, or is it to help fund the pharmaceutical industry? And I'm sure there's a lot of people in the NHS who really want to help people.
Tongue-in-cheek, was it?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's deliberate, but it's like when you spend your life maybe negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, being bombarded with their propaganda and stuff, it's easy to sort of slowly sort of, you know, they're going to solve your problems for you, right? We're going to do this vaccination program is going to solve the problems. Nobody's saying, you know, we're just going to help GlaxoSmithKline make more money. But that can be the effect of many years.
There is a perception that in this day and age, doctors and nurses are becoming the salespersons
mm-hmm.
of pharmaceutical companies. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and I mean, they're the best salespeople because they believe that they're helping you, and the reason why they're being financially rewarded so well is because they're doing such a good job of helping you. They don't realize that they're slowly becoming immersed in this propaganda that the pharmaceutical companies put out. Do the vaccine manufacturers claim that their vaccines will reduce cervical cancer?
I've never seen that claim. The words that the manufacturers use are that this vaccine is intended to reduce cervical cancer or expected to reduce cervical cancer. I don't think I've ever seen it where they say it will reduce cervical cancer.
Because there is no data showing that the vaccine reduces cervical cancer. Because if there is, I'm sure it would be printed in big, fat letters on their labels.
Absolutely.
I mean, if I was in marketing at a vaccine manufacturer and I had a study that showed that my vaccine reduced cervical cancer, I would put it front and center in the information that was given out.
One of the things that we've been saying recently, I've been following quite closely the situation in Ireland, which is quite close to us. It's becoming almost warfare over there.
Right.
There's the Irish association, support association for those that have been injured by the vaccine called Regret.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been accused of terrorism.
Right. Now there was, I mean, the Irish politicians, like politicians just about everywhere, tend to be on the side of the pharmaceutical industry, the health establishment, etc. But there was one government minister who had previously stated he had some concerns about HPV and that he took the concerns of Regret seriously. So what's happened to him?
That was Finian McGrath, and he's come under a lot of criticism. It was in a newspaper last week that he was quite sure that he'd heard it, that in England there'd been 30% of the adverse events were serious. But he wasn't absolutely certain, and he couldn't remember where he got the information from.
Mm.
And the media
just went all over
absolutely,
him.
They just absolutely crucified him.
Even though it was true.
Even though it was true. In fact, I've written to him. He's not replied to me yet. But even though it was true, it was actually 34%. It was in a parliamentary question.
Right.
It was 34% of the overall were classed as serious. But Gardasil, which is the vaccine of choice in Ireland, it is 40% of the adverse reactions are serious. And in fact, there are a small number of reports of adverse reactions with Gardasil 9, which I presume is only privately available in the UK for the last 2 years. And that had got 60% of serious adverse events. So
well,
unfortunately, the guy who thought he'd got some information but he wasn't certain, they ridiculed him. He has conceded he's going to toe the party line now, and yes, he will raise the concerns of his constituents, but he will support the party policy.
This way of doing science, where you basically get a majority opinion and then the majority gangs up on the minority until there's no minority voices left, this is not science.
Well, certainly in Ireland, they are fighting this tooth and nail. And they've got, I think it's 30 groups of the Irish Cancer Society is one of them, and they're in the media almost every day, and those the Irish Cancer Society and these other support groups and government ministers, they just keep quoting this ridiculous number of deaths, and even teachers and school nurses are telling young girls of 12 and 13, you will die if you don't have this vaccine.
Which is ridiculous, because cervical cancer has never been a really high-frequency cancer.
In Western countries, it certainly hasn't. I think pap screening came in about 40 years ago. The occurrence of cervical cancers these days, I think it's 7.8 per 100,000 of the population.
Yeah, I mean, that's significant.
Cases per 100,000. And deaths from cervical cancer came down from 8 per 100,000 to 2 per 100,000 before the vaccine was introduced.
Right, so it's...
So it was coming down very, very rapidly before the vaccine was introduced.
So where did these numbers come from? Did somebody just make them up, or is there some misinterpretation of data? Like, how did they get the 90 people are going to die of cancer, I don't know if that's every year, and 300 are going to get treated for cancer because of the lack of take-up of the vaccine?
It seems to be totally overquoted. As I've mentioned earlier, I've analysed the reporting of cervical cancer cases in the English, the government statistics database site, and also Scotland. I went and searched the Irish government's database for cervical cancer reporting only a few days ago, and it's only updated to 2013. Now, for something which is so important to them, and such a political issue, and such a confrontational issue, to have their national database only updated to 2013, either they are withholding the results, or they are not very efficient at getting their reporting done.
Well, I saw
this. They really ought to be focusing on this to determine the true facts.
I saw the same thing with AIDS. From about 1984 to 1997, the amount of information that was published grew and became more comprehensive. But suddenly in 1997, they started every year removing information in their reports until the reports are to the point where they're virtually meaningless, because it was becoming more and more clear from their statistics that they weren't getting anywhere with the AIDS epidemic, and the more statistics they produced, the more obvious it was. In this case, you know, maybe the number of cases of cervical cancer is going up in Ireland. That would be pretty embarrassing. Is there any support in either the British or the Irish media for critical voices?
There is some support, but it is very small and very limited. There appears to be the vast majority of media outlets are suppressed when it comes to printing anything adverse against vaccines.
Yeah, and it seems to have suddenly ramped up since the measles so-called epidemic a couple of years ago. I noticed that from that point on, and I think it was correlated with a mandatory vaccine program in California, that basically no criticism, even indirect or tentative, of vaccines would be allowed any longer.
I haven't researched this, but my understanding is from other sources that the amount of funding into media from pharmaceutical companies through advertising or other avenues, and the amount of funding and support, financial support to health services from pharmaceutical companies is so huge that the owners of the media companies can't afford to lose that revenue.
Yeah, I also think I'm not so convinced of that. I think maybe a bigger factor is that the heads of the media organizations and the heads of the pharmaceutical organizations and the heads of the government agencies are all buddies. They're all rich people who hang around together
and scratch
each other's back. And when, you know, the head of a big pharmaceutical company says to you know, who's the guy, the media guy everybody loves to hate, the Australian guy, Rupert Murdoch, you know, when they say to Rupert Murdoch, you know, we need to get everybody with this vaccine, they do a sales job on him, and all of a sudden his newspapers are 100% on side. Okay, so we only have a little bit of time left, but you included in some of the things you sent me, and I think I'd seen this before, there's a letter from a doctor named Sinhang Lee to Dr. Margaret Chan, who's the Director General of the World Health Organization. Can you briefly summarize some of the concerns he had about the HPV vaccine and some of the decisions by the World Health Organization to approve it?
You've asked me a difficult question there. I can only give you... I don't have all the details in front of me. I do recall reading the letter when it was first issued.
Okay.
And I have had contact with Dr. Sinhang Lee. He's an absolute gentleman. He replies to any request for help almost immediately. But he wrote a very extensive letter, as you say, to the World Health Organization. When he came across fabrications, that were, and conversation, there were some emails that came to light that had probably been picked up, or that the email trail had been left in some emails that shouldn't have been there, and it was found out that the World Health Organization representatives at some very high level meetings were fabricating information to manipulate the situation with respect to the effectiveness of the vaccine, in fact, all different kinds of manipulation to make it appear better than what it is.
Well, okay, so let's talk about aluminum, because that's in these letters. There's a lot of concerns about the fact that the adjuvant, the chemical in the vaccine that's supposed to make the immune reaction stronger, is aluminum, and it binds to viral DNA that's in these letters. So what are your concerns with aluminum in both of the HPV vaccines?
We have a research scientist with a huge amount of knowledge on the body burden of, excuse my pronunciation, of aluminium.
Okay, you're allowed to say that.
Professor Chris Exley.
I've interviewed him, actually.
Professor Chris Exley at Keele University is extremely knowledgeable about the body burden of aluminium. And he is extremely critical. He has many, many studies, many peer-reviewed articles. He's an expert witness. He has a global annual conference called the Keele Conference, which is the Keele University where it started. In fact, I think that the Keele Conference in this year was actually in Canada.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, there's a Keele Conference, I think it's every year, it might be every 2 years. He's held them in Austria, I think. He's held them in the West Indies. You can go on YouTube and watch some of the conferences. But he is a world-leading authority on body burden of aluminium.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very critical of the aluminium in vaccines.
Right. And both of these vaccines seem to be using aluminium in a different way than previous vaccines.
Well, my understanding is they're both genetically, the first of a new generation of genetically engineered, genetically modified, GM vaccines, that because they're genetically engineered, they require a much stronger boost from the adjuvant. And the aluminium has been used in vaccines. It probably replaced mercury previously. Because it was perceived as being less toxic than mercury, but in actual fact, it's probably just as toxic, if not more toxic.
Yeah, I don't think so, because mercury was used in thimerosal, that's a preservative, whereas aluminum is an adjuvant, but I think they...
And the quantity is increased. Now, I believe
right.
It's been increased, particularly because of the need for extra push from the adjuvant, because the vaccine itself is genetically engineered and not measles or mumps or rubella.
Right.
So my understanding is it requires a much stronger boost from the adjuvant to be effective against the strains of HPV that are in the vaccine.
Okay, where does the movement that's concerned about HPV vaccination go from here? I mean, you've got politicians against you, you've got the health authorities against you, you've got the media against you. Are you making any headway with this and
well,
how?
We have associations. I co-founded Association of Vaccine Injured Daughters in the UK in 2015, together with Frieda Birrell. She's the chair of our association. I'm the vice chair. We've now got 475 members. Regret in Ireland have got more than 400 members. We're doing lots of research. We're finding out data. I don't know if you are familiar with the World Health Organization's own database, Adverse Drug Reactions, at
no.
the Uppsala Monitoring Center in Sweden. Its address is www.vgaccess.org, and the number of reports of adverse reactions on their database is over 76,000. The number of adverse reactions reported on the database are 292,000. The number of deaths is 400. The number of neoplasms is 890.
Cancers.
Including cervical cancers and pea cancers. Now, those numbers are absolutely huge. And to say that you can't prove that the vaccine caused them, they can't all be coincidences.
No,
but there are a number of things. We're doing research. We're sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
Our organization shares lots of information with the United States, with Spain, with Colombia, with Japan,
right,
with Denmark, with Germany. So we are growing in numbers. Certainly, Colombia is going through a pretty hectic time at the moment. They've got 700 cases that are going to court, a class action.
And are there other countries that have lawsuits? Like I heard in Japan, there's...
Japan, I think it's 60 or 70.
Right.
But they stopped recommending the vaccine in Japan quite soon. I think it was only ever recommended for 2 or 3 years, and it was stopped quite soon being recommended. So the number of lawsuits there is reduced. But here in the UK, we find that the government and the Department of Health is just one total brick wall. They won't listen. They resist everything. They fight everything tooth and nail. It is very difficult. But they did similar with the pandemic flu vaccine. They denied for a number of years, 3, 4, or 5 years. They kept denying that cases of narcolepsy in the UK were not the fault of the pandemic flu vaccine. But then my understanding is they introduced a national program of vaccination with pandemics in Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And it was when there was 1,000 cases of narcolepsy in Europe, which became associated with the pandemic flu vaccine, that eventually the Department of Health in the UK conceded and accepted that there was a link between pandemic flu vaccine and narcolepsy. In fact, quite a number of the girls affected in the UK by the cervix vaccine, there's a number of them that have been diagnosed with narcolepsy or narcolepsy-like illness. And the adjuvant used in Pandemrix is not the same identical adjuvant as used in cervix and Pandemrix. One was called ASO3, the next one is called ASO4. My understanding is there are many similarities, even if they're not identical.
Right. I mean, that seems to be one commonality. I think, when I first learned about concerns about vaccines, mercury was what I was more concerned about, but as they started to take mercury out of vaccines, or at least reduce the dose significantly, there were still problems with vaccines, and aluminum seems to be increasing, and nobody in the establishment is saying that there's any problems with aluminum, even though aluminum's known to cause problems.
Well, what I do know is that aluminium ingested, the amount that the body burden can take when it's ingested orally, is far greater than what it is when it's injected into the bloodstream. When it's injected into the bloodstream, together with one of the adjuvants in the cervix vaccine, certainly is an emulsifier, and almost certainly there has been vaccine that has got and aluminium that's got past the blood-brain barrier onto the brains of these girls that are affected. You mentioned Dr. Singh Ang Lee earlier. He, together with some researchers in Canada, I think it was, they looked at brain tissue from two girls that had died.
Was this Chris Shaw?
Chris Shaw and Lucia Tomaljanovic.
Right, at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And they found vaccine residue and aluminium on the brain tissue of two girls that had died, one from New Zealand and one from the United States. I understand that that Dr. Sin Ang Lee has also been involved in post-mortem of young children, young adults that have died from this vaccine, and he is absolutely certain that this vaccine is causing all of the problems that have been reported.
Yes. Well, Steve, we've run out of time. It's been a really good conversation. I don't think I'm finished talking about HPV. It's a big subject. Opens up a lot of different avenues.
The one thing we didn't talk about was the video that has just been released yesterday that's already been seen. It's had almost 5,000 views in 1.5 days. We contributed. The producer was Joan Shenton.
Yes.
Sacrificial Virgins.
Sacrificial Virgins.
It is absolutely superb. It's on YouTube.
Right.
It's a series of 3 12.5-minute documentary films. The first one has been was released 1.5 days ago.
Yes.
There's been global press releases, and it's been seen by 5,000. There's been 5,000 views in 1.5 days. But
yes.
It's not just film of vaccine damaged children and rhetoric from parents. It has got some serious science and medical contributions to this documentary as well.
Yes. I'm thinking I need to interview. I've interviewed Joan Shenton at least twice before, but I on different subjects, so I may have to interview her again on these documentaries. And there's 3 coming
She's
out.
A
the first one.
Wonderful person and a wonderful
yes.
presenter.
She
speaks so fluently and so convincingly, but she's very very professional, very very good at preparing documentaries.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you telling me what you've learned, and I'm very sorry what happened to your daughter to start this whole thing. But you've done the best with out of a bad situation that you can be, which is to fight for other people.
Absolutely. We don't want other people to suffer like my family. My daughter has suffered tremendously, but my wife and myself and my daughter's sister, our family has been devastated for over 6 years.
Right.
And we don't want other people to suffer like we do.
Yes.
We want to do.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily so.
Yes. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Goodbye.
Thanks, Rach, indeed.
Thank you for listening to episode 155 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.